Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the story of the two friends who met after having not seen each other for quite a period of time. And the first one remarked to the second one, "How's your wife?" The second one responded, "Compared to what?" And it seems to me that that is at least one response that could be made to the question that's posed in the topic that we're discussing today. Compared to what will capitalism survive or not survive? Further, it seems that a serious attempt to really answer the question would seem to require more attention than I'm going to give it, at least, to what is capitalism and to the precise meaning of the word survive and to the time frame for this survival. For example, I believe that the broad concept of private enterprise is, even at this point in time, so strongly entrenched and supported in the minds of most of the public and even most of the politicians that any serious attempt to attack private property as a concept would be repelled. Having said that, however, I hasten to add that this does not mean that the Congress might not make attempts to nationalize certain big interest groups such as the energy producers. In animals, survival is the difference between life and death, and it seems to me that this point usually is fairly easy to determine. An application of this principle to capitalism, however, is not so easy and not so precise. I do not expect capitalism to die, at least in the immediate future. On the other hand, its physical condition is less than healthy, and history suggests that this may very well be a chronic condition for capitalism. Further, there are a variety of viruses and cancerous forces which threaten both the patient's recovery and its ultimate survival. And because we have two economists on the panel today, I'm going to talk about some of those forces and leave the solution to curing the patient's problems to Warren and Art. Let me begin by suggesting that no defense of capitalism will probably ever be generally accepted as a definitive situation. Therefore, my answer to the question posed in the topic is maybe. Survival for capitalism, it seems to me, is a political decision, and there are several forces at work in our society today which not only threaten capitalism, but the very society of which our economic system is a part. And I'm going to call your attention to a few of those now and mention some names, at least, that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Let me begin by talking about economic illiteracy, or the public image of business, as it's usually written about in the popular media. For several years, at least for 30, which I've traced the record back looking at some opinion research polling data, the public has had their opinions and attitudes measured, both in terms of general attitudes, do we like or dislike, support or not support, as well as some questions raised which are attempts to find out how much knowledge the public really possesses about the economic system. I'm not going to repeat these findings for you. Most of you have seen all that information. One thing we seem to have learned is that the public is economically illiterate. But I hasten to point out that all of the public is not illiterate about the same aspects of the economy. And consequently, the traditional economic education efforts that have been supported in large part by the business community and others has a very difficult problem because the economic knowledge possessed by the public is spotty. Given this fact, however, I still must say that the polls suggest that despite this widespread ignorance, despite the suspicion, at least in particular about big business, private enterprise as a concept is still widely supported by a majority of the American people. They are suspicious in particular about big business. And perhaps this may be attributable, at least in part in this time over the last several months, to the rapid price increases, to high levels of unemployment, to energy problems, and to the publicity given to illegal corporate contributions. One last point that I would like to make with regards to some of the economic education programs. Compton Advertising Agency undertook a survey in the early part of 1975. They published some of the results in April, and the total results are now available for anyone who has $10 and would like to buy them. One of the most significant things, it seems to me, that was pointed out was that it was awfully difficult to establish a direct correlation between economics and an attitude toward business. In fact, the Compton survey went so far as to suggest that economic attitudes seem to result in people largely as a result of personal experiences, not necessarily those gained in a classroom. With the problem of lack of understanding of business, threatened capitalism, the business community is, at this point in time, financing a variety of organizations. I personally have a list that approaches about 55 in number. Most of these organizations are attempting to resolve this problem. Most of these organizations direct their results largely towards students and teachers. This has always been a bit ironic to me because teachers, most of them in the United States, work for tax-supported public institutions. They've not ever been notably out in the forefront of those people who were interested in competition and maybe not even excellence. And certainly we know from various studies that have been undertaken that most of the teachers in the social studies classes of the nation's classrooms clearly do not understand economics themselves. And from reading George Stigler, if from no other source, one should understand that it is something more than a 6 weeks cram course in the summer before we're going to be able to teach social studies teachers a full range of economic theories. Clearly, the polls are worse today than they have ever been in the past. Businessmen, in reacting to these polls, tend to concentrate on one central thesis. That is, the public simply doesn't understand us. They don't understand that our margin of profit on sales is very, very small. For those of you who haven't seen the last poll, I will give you one statistic. The present median estimate of profits as a return on sales is 33%. That's up from 28% about 2 years ago. It's up only 13% when the poll was first taken in 1945. So my argument is that the public's never understood how much profit the business community makes on sales, and I'm not even sure that it's relevant to their understanding of capitalism. It would be helpful, but I'm not sure it's all that relevant. If we wanted to take this approach, it seems to me we have to ask ourselves a whole series of questions. Number one, can we, in fact, make the public economically literate? And if we could, we have to be able to say with some degree of preciseness, what is economic literacy? Tell you a story. The NAM has been running an essay contest over the past, I guess it was announced in June. The deadline was November 1, so I need no more entries. The basic idea behind the essay contest was to express the benefits of the private enterprise system during the 200 years of the American experience. Let me show you how difficult economic literacy is as a concept. And I'm not picking on the junior achievement people. They were quite nice. They supported the contest. I got an awful lot of essays. But I do want to tell you about one essay that I received from one youngster out in the Midwest. He was waxing as eloquently as he knew how on the benefits of competition. And then he needed to give an example. By this time, we're at the top of page two. It was only a two-page essay. And he said, for example, he says, perhaps you have had the experience that I have had. I went into the grocery store recently, and I bought a pack of potato chips for 89 cents, the twin-pack variety. To my surprise, when I got home, the bags were only half full. Now, you might notice a bit of consumerism involved here. Then he continued and said, now, if we didn't have competition, you might have paid $2 for that bag of potato chips, and the bags would only have been one quarter full. So, at least in that case, we have one young man who has found out all there is to know about competition. It's my judgment, after 12 years at the NAM playing around the fringes of this economic education in one way or another for most of that time, that economic education programs, as I have observed them normally conducted in the United States, will not necessarily result in increased support for private enterprise, capitalism, free enterprise, or even a free society. I know too many PhDs in economics, as well as other very literate men, who do not hold the views that I hold, or the views which I think are supportive of private enterprise, or the free society, and it seems to me that this is prima facie evidence that economics in and of itself is not the total answer. Now, because I have some friends in the audience, some of whom are involved in economic education, as I have been in various capacities over the years, let me add a P.S. Yes, I am in favor of economic literacy and most other forms of literacy, but I think it's high time, especially in the business community, that we learn that something else is required if we're going to be able to deal effectively with this problem. For as all of us are aware, the existence of an anti-business bias is not a new phenomenon. There has been conflict virtually since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution between the intellectual world and the business world. And even prior to this time, there was a struggle for power between the secular intellectuals and the officials of the church for control of the society. This type of conflict suggests one of the causes of the anti-business bias probably is a result of a power struggle, which I would suggest is being played deliberately by intellectual thought leaders and somewhat less deliberately by business leaders who are not necessarily always aware that through the development of strong economic institutions, they do possess considerable power. Irving Kristol recently, I think it was in the May 19th issue of the Wall Street Journal, added some to this dimension of the discussion when he discussed what he called the new class, in which he suggested that there were large numbers of people in the United States who were not misinformed about our economic system, who did in fact understand it, and who didn't like the results of it. In essence, Irving was suggesting that there are large groups of people in the country who are attempting to shift what have traditionally been private economic decisions into the political arena. Having made those remarks, let me now share just a sentence or two on some of my own personal concerns, which I hope are shared by a few of you. It seems to me that as I look at the American private enterprise system, that it has been predicated throughout the years on a moral philosophy. And it is this philosophy which is under attack. It is not the efficiency of the corporation or the capability of the productive capacity of our enterprise system, which seems to me that is drawing the brunt of the attacks today. Consequently, a simple belief in the free enterprise system is not sufficient, for it will not sustain and energize the moral force which is needed to counter the stream of influences which are contrary to the philosophy supporting the American economic system. There is a great need for a deeper understanding of the philosophy which undergirds our social, economic, and political systems. For an increased understanding of these values is critical to their continued existence. And yet, these values seems to me at least, are being questioned more today than ever before, and in fact, rejected out of hand by large numbers. Now, let me, almost at random, although obviously that was not the way I arrived at this, let me call to your attention some of the factors which I believe could account for value changes in our society, which in turn may lead to anti-business or anti-capitalist positions. First example is a professor by the name of Herman T. Epstein, who's a professor of biology at Brandeis. He suggests that the changes in social values can be traced to two ideas. First, Darwin's theory of evolution, and secondly, society's increased knowledge of the human condition. Now, let me make a few comments here and use a couple of quotations from him and attribute much of this to his reasoning. He reasons that in today's world, a large number of people, larger than ever before, have become acquainted with the Darwin theory of natural selection. This knowledge has revealed to these people a fundamental weakness in the basic philosophical values which support Western society. A result is that large numbers of people find it impossible to believe in any philosophy which goes beyond the parameters of their own experience. Consequently, there are no absolutes as a basis for forming moral judgments. This is the world of the relativists. Without an ethical system of some type, there can be no acceptable purpose or reason for living. And since, at least according to Epstein, and here I'm quoting, most people have no genuine purposes, end of quote, it becomes necessary to develop new insights, new outlooks, new social structures, and new reasons for people to live again, and now I'm quoting, as humans, rather than as highly evolved animals, end of quotations. Now, the second cause of value changes in terms of understanding the human condition, I suggest, along with Epstein's comments, that technology has played a large role, and technology and communications is probably the thing that has made it possible for most people across the planet to, quote, understand the human condition more than before. Epstein indicates, and here I'm quoting, that this knowledge has robbed us of our innocence. We can all know that only materialist rewards are available from existing or evolving social, political, and economic systems, end of quotations. And these two factors have created a social situation, at least in the West, in which there is no effective moral or philosophical force external to the individual which has the capacity to motivate an interest in what society has to offer. Consequently, young people are bored with the opportunities offered them by today's society and today's industry. And this decline in moral force has resulted in the rejection of authority, aimless rebellion, use of drugs, cultural dropouts, etc., etc. Now, it's quite probable that a major change has taken place in the way that influence and ideas are generated in the country today. Almost everyone who deals with mass communications, seems to me at least, many of them, still assumes the validity of the three-step theory of idea dissemination proposed by Berylson, Lazarsfeld, and Gaudet back in 1948. In the first step, you'll recall a few academics or creative thinkers develop an idea. In the second step, these ideas are conveyed to opinion leaders who become supporters of these ideas. And thirdly, they use their influence to indoctrinate those of us who are down at the bottom of the pyramid, the general public. There is a point of view today which maintains that the pattern of influence is controlled by a small group of vocal activists who maintain a heavy and constant input to two groups of opinion leaders. First of all, educators and those people in the media who can influence mass attitudes by their own actions. And the second group of people that these vocal agitators are trying to reach are the legislators and the bureaucrats, those who hold political power, those who can take actions which will affect the lives of other people. The result is that the input received by those making decisions comes from a small group of vocal activists who motivate the media and intellectuals, and they in turn motivate those who hold political power. There is little input from the private sector or the general public. Compounding these circumstances is television. The business community, and we like to think that we're rational, making hard, realistic decisions, the business community stresses facts. We stress organizations. We stress reality. We attempt, in making business decisions, to eliminate as many variables and unknowns as is possible. By contrast, television creates emotion. Its format stresses a neat and quick solution to every problem imaginable. Television creates impatience with slow-moving institutions, and I guess I'd have to say that many of the public now think of private enterprise as being in that category. Our economic system, as all of you are aware, is based upon rules. Television is based upon emotion. Society, it seems to me, is based on history and tradition. TV on immediacy and novelty. This is an age of visibility and action. The entire process by which human attitudes are formed has been changed by television. The dramatic event, the rapid trend, and the ability to transport people physically to the scene where the action is taking place. The importance to capitalism is seen by comparing the excessive levels of expectations held by much of the public for quick, and I might point out, painless solutions to all of the problems which we face in the real world of life. One result is that management decisions in the private sector, as well as within the public sector, largely now are made with the idea of avoiding hostility rather than with achieving the desired results. This suggests a possible built-in slowdown of the economy, which in turn, I would predict, will become a cause of increased dissatisfaction in the years ahead. Let me give you just one other point of view and cut this short, because there are several examples that I could call your attention to. Let me try, for example, a book called Chance and Necessity, written by Jacques Monod. Monod is a director of the Pasteur Institute in France, professor at the College of France, and a Nobel Prize winner in microbiology in 1965. Strange guy for a business fellow to be reading, but I found some interesting ideas in here that I think have an impact upon what's going on in the intellectual world, which in turn is influencing the future and survival of capitalism. In his book, Chance and Necessity, Monod expounds a philosophy which he says seeks to sweep away as both false and dangerous the animist conception of man that has dominated virtually all Western view from those of primitive cultures to the present time. His arguments, based on recent biological research, contend that man is the indisputable product of chance genetic mutation. Now, I don't personally care whether you believe that, and you shouldn't care whether I believe that. The significance of this is whether there are large numbers of people who do believe it, and consequently, what are the results? Let me give you just a little quotation from him to drive home the point that I think he's making. In the course of three centuries, science, founded upon the postulate of objectivity, has conquered its place in society, in men's practice, but not in their hearts. Modern societies are built upon science. They owe their wealth, their power, and the certitude that far greater wealth and powers still will be ours if we so wish. Modern societies accept the treasures and the power that science laid in their laps, but they have not accepted, they scarcely even heard its profounder message, the defining of a new and unique source of truth, and the demand for a thorough revision of ethical premises, for a total break with the animist tradition, the definitive abandonment of the old covenant, the necessity of forging a new one. I hasten to add that Mr. Monod is a confessed socialist. But the point I think that I'm trying to make here is that not only does the business community have a problem, society has a problem, because a deterioration in the philosophical beliefs which are supportive of the society and its economic system can lead to a point where both government and individuals will behave in irrational ways, at least until such time as a generally accepted set of new values has been accepted by most of the public. For those of you that are interested in pursuing this line of reasoning, you might take a look at an article that Bill Marina did called The 4E Factors. Irving Kristol has written in a variety of sources about this recently. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.